me here on this Wednesday, September 26th edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host. So next hour and 5 hour and 10 minutes or so is go over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Glad to have you with me for this hump day edition of the show. Two guests joined me on the program today. The first, professional handicapper Brian Leonard from wagertalk.com. We're going to chat about the NFL and college football markets for this week. Talk about some general betting tips with increased totals in the NFL. Also some adjustments from a power rating standpoint. And then in the second half of today's show, we'll chat with Wes Reynolds at Wes Reynolds and the number one on Twitter. We're going to do some derivative betting talk with him. Then also take a look at the Ryder Cup. We had a great segment yesterday with Brian Blessing. We'll try to do some more Ryder Cup stuff here today because, you know, while it's probably not the biggest of betting markets out there, a lot of opportunities here with the format for that tournament. And then, of course, such a very exciting thing to watch as well if you want to get up in the middle of the night or if you haven't DVR'd. Lots of good opportunities in that tournament, so we'll make sure that we talk about that on today's show. Over at bangthebook.com, I've got a Ryder Cup preview as well as my updated college football power ratings, a look at today's MLB card. We've got the opening line report for the NFL and college football, situational betting spots for college football, misleading box scores for college football. We'll have a new NFL power ratings piece from Danny Vorgs either today or tomorrow. We've got a lot of stuff going on over at bangthebook.com, where we are your one-stop shop for sports betting news and information. Don't forget about our free pick contests, archived versions of the show, whether you want the full show or the segments, sportsbook reviews, of course, our review of DSI Sportsbook, and you know that they offer that Bang 100 promo code for our Bang the Book radio listeners with a 100% deposit bonus for the sportsbook over there at BetDSI, where it's only a game until you bet it. But if you have an account at DSI, we've got reviews of Five Dimes, Bookmaker, BetOnline, ViaBet, BetAnySports, all those different outlets that are out there so that you can shop around for the best prices in both the college football and the NFL betting markets. But NHL starts next Wednesday. NBA, I think, is 2 or 3 weeks away from starting. Obviously, college basketball coming up as well. Major League Baseball playoffs. You want to get the best series price. So very important to shop around. Use the resources over at bangthebook.com to help you figure out which is the best fit for you. We got two guests here today on the program. The first one is professional handicapper Brian Leonard from wagertalk.com. Brian, how's it going today, man?
Everything's going great. How's everything over there?
Doing very well. Appreciate your time as always, Brian. Thank you so much for joining us. And I want to start in the NFL here for this week because I want to continue a discussion that we had on yesterday's show with Rolf Michaels, a good friend of yours, somebody that I know you're very familiar with. And we were talking about NFL totals and how totals are, you know, really going up here this year, both because we've got, you know, a lot of high powered offenses, but also because we're seeing penalties every time you sneeze or cough on a player. So kind of have to increase the expectation for scoring here. And I know that you're a big teaser bettor, and we've talked about teasers a couple times with you here so far this season, where you kind of look for those correlated opportunities of getting a lot of points in a low scoring game, bringing a favorite down. When it comes to the inflated totals that we're seeing here in the market, Brian, have you found that it's had a negative impact on teasers? Has it had a positive effect? What do you think?
Yeah, actually, it's a negative. Anytime you've got more points scored in the game, there's going to be more variance, and that's not good for teaser bettors. What you want as a teaser bettor is the game to play out exactly the way it was supposed to. For example, this week, the best teaser half that I've seen all season long is going as the Jets travel to Jacksonville. No opinion on the game regarding to the teaser, but you're looking at Jacksonville as a 7.5-point favorite with a total of 38.5. Now, anytime you can get, you're crossing the key numbers, 3, 4, 6, and 7, it's actually called a Stanford Wong teaser. So that would take you Jacksonville down to 1.5. And with the total of 38.5 means there's not going to be many points scored in that game. So it works out very well. But then you've got other games where you're scoring, you know, especially the Kansas City games, you've got 56 points on the Monday Night Football game. There was a good spot should have been a good spot last Monday night when you have the Steelers getting 1.5 at one point. But the problem was the total was in the 54-55 range, so I didn't play it because of the high total and the high variance. What you're looking for is the smaller lines and the smaller totals. So especially the totals, If you can get totals right now, probably 43 or less, those are your best spots. Problem is, you'll see maybe one game a weekend that has that, and it also has to have the great number for you to play the teasers through the key numbers. As we're sitting here talking on the phone, my fire alarm's starting to beep, so that's probably what you're hearing in the background, a bad timing issue. But, yeah, from a teaser standpoint, it's not nearly as good as it used to be, and it's so hard to get places to give you the true teaser. As you say, a six-point teaser, and then when you say the line is a certain number, then you go in as a six-point teaser, and then they have it landing right on a number, not half a point, which is not what you're looking for. So they're playing around with it. It's getting harder and harder to win on teasers, and that's just the way it is right now. And, you know, the smart bettors have been beating the books and teasers for years and years, and they finally caught up to us. They used to be at 110 for a six-point teaser. Now they moved to 120 on a six-point teaser, and now they're doing all these other things, like five dimes is always moving teaser protection. But that's just the way they got to do to make money, and, you know, I guess I can't blame them. If it was my business, I'd be doing the same thing. But teasers are the thing that we're going to be talking about, is one of the things we used to make a lot of money on in the NFL years ago that we just don't get many opportunities now.
Well, I mean, when you look at other teaser games here this week, I'm sure the Rams will be a popular team coming down from 6.5 to, you know, half a point or even a pick 'em with a 6.5-point teaser. The Patriots will be a popular team again, even though they were a popular teaser pick last week. Didn't look very good against Detroit on Sunday Night Football. So there are some opportunities out there, at least from a spread standpoint. But again, you're talking about a Minnesota and Rams game where you've got a total of 49.5 for two teams that are supposed to have pretty good defenses. Then Miami and New England, a total that has come down a little bit, probably because of how Tom Brady looked last Sunday night. But, you know, we talk about teasing teams down and getting those key numbers 3, 4, 6, and 7. Do you ever tease a team up? I mean, do you find opportunities where you want to take an underdog and put them into a bigger underdog role?
Oh, definitely. Those to me are actually even better, especially if it's a road dog. For example, right now, Cleveland sitting at 2.5, catching 2.5 against Oakland. You could pay extra juice to get the 3, but with a total of 44.5, I'm seeing it at one or two places. That would be a game where you would just tease Cleveland from 2.5 to 8.5, and that would be your second part of the teaser. And like I said, the numbers are 45, which is one of the lowest numbers on the board. That's something you want to take a look at. You had mentioned the Rams and New England. And from a teaser standpoint, what you want to do is play 7.5 and under, or 1.5 and over. When you get a line to 6.5 or 7, you're actually better off playing it on the money line as opposed to playing it in a teaser, because you're already under that number of 7, that key number of 7, which we all know, other than 3, 7s are very important, 6, 4 are very important. So I would have played, if you're going to play those, I would play the Rams on the money line and New England on the money line instead of using them as a teaser.
So what are you looking for here in terms of teasing the underdogs up? I mean, are you looking for lower totals, or is it one of those things where you basically just do teasers from a correlated standpoint with the total? I mean, you'll get a team like Cincinnati, for example. I think Cincinnati moves the football in this game on Sunday. They're a 5-point underdog right now. Maybe some people don't love the 5 because all of a sudden Atlanta has figured it out in the red zone. But I do think the Bengals move the football. Atlanta with several key defensive injuries. Is there any value in taking a team plus 5 and teasing them up to 11, something like that?
No. The only time you can make money teasing is going from covering the key numbers 3, 4, 6, and 7. So anytime other than that, there's better ways to approach the game than using it as a teaser. I also like the Cincinnati. I was hoping it would get back to 6, but now it looks like the sharp books are heading down. So I was waiting for my clients on this, but I plan on using Cincinnati. And it's just, there's just not enough key numbers going from 5 to 11. You've got 6, 7, 10. Well, that's not going to be nearly as important as 3, 4, 6, and 7. So there's better ways to get that. But you're always looking for lower scoring games, because what you want out of lower scoring games is there's less variance. And when you get, like, for example, last week we had Atlanta and we had New Orleans. and two of the better offenses, two of the lesser defenses. There's going to be a lot of points on the board, and it ended up being a pretty close game and ended up going to overtime. But if one of the teams would have won that game 45-20, nobody would have given it much thought. But when you've got like Jacksonville against the Jets this week, if somebody wins 45-20, that's way off of what they thought there was going to be in that game, because you're expecting it to be a low-scoring game. So anytime it's a low-scoring game is what you want to approach those on, especially if you've got teams that run the football. Don't pass the football. I've mentioned in the past, if you can get a team, like in the past Kansas City when Schottenheimer was there, he rarely passed the football. He had a team that didn't turn the ball over. So he would run, and it was just a tremendous advantage playing a team like that. But nowadays, you've got the higher scoring games, and we've got so many rookie quarterbacks and second-year quarterbacks playing. There could be interceptions and bad plays, and all of a sudden you've got a high-scoring game that just gets out of hand, and it's going to hurt your teaser.
Well, that's an important thing there, and that's why I kind of set it up for that Cincinnati-Atlanta game for our listeners out there, because it's not necessarily just the point of getting extra points on an underdog or bringing down a favorite. It's covering those key numbers. And again, for Cincinnati there, well, yeah, they may end up scoring, and yeah, that's a game with a total in the 50s, and having 11.5 is, you know, something that feels a lot more comfortable for you. Again, the true value in a teaser is crossing those key numbers. So that is something I definitely wanted to drive home for our listeners here, something I want them to keep in mind. So, Brian, let's talk about a couple of games here specifically for Sunday, beginning with game 253-254, Indianapolis and Houston. If you like the Texans side here, crossing some key numbers with a six-point teaser, as they're a 1.5-point underdog in this spot. And, Brian, I got to say, you know, I thought the move up from -2 to -2.5 or -1.5 to -2.5 made a lot more sense to me than this number coming back down. Surprised to see this number come back down a little bit?
Well, Houston really hasn't done a whole lot this year, offensively at least, and the defense hasn't been nearly as good as what we expected. Defense has been better than the offense, but it's tough to put a lot of stock into this Houston team right now. They're expected to be so much better. But when you take a look at Watson, he just doesn't – either he doesn't have the mobility that he's had before, or the team has just told him, hey, if you're going to be successful, you can't be running. We can't let you get hit. And when you take a look at the teams like, you know, Indianapolis, it's very similar. It's very similar to a lot of – these are somewhat younger quarterbacks, especially Watson, but they remind me more of a Tom Brady, some of the other Peyton Mannings, that they don't want him to get hurt. And so they get rid of the ball as quick as possible. And, you know, with Watson, that was a major part of his success last year, is when you get a quarterback that can run. And that's a major problem with a lot of these quarterbacks out there, that if they can run, it's such a dual threat to the defenses that it's so good to have a player like that. The problem is, when you have a player like that, you get injuries, and that's happened to just about all of them over the years, the Randall Cunninghams and the like, who just got knocked out of the league. You know, RG3 still there, Baltimore, playing for Baltimore right now, and he's not the same quarterback without his legs, and it's his whole career was cost by getting hurt when he was trying to run. So I don't think a whole lot about this Houston team. It is a 47, which is probably higher than what I like to do for a teaser, but this is what you would want to do. And getting back to the teaser talk for just a second, there's books out there. In fact, you can probably look it up on the internet as to the value of each and every point, every half a point when you're looking at a teaser. So keep in mind, when you're paying money for that teaser, you're paying for those 6 points. And if it doesn't match up to what you need, it's not a good deal. So if you look at a number and going from 11 to 11.5 is worth 2 cents, and going from 11.5 to 12 is worth 2 cents, you realize that those numbers aren't as popular and aren't as chance for it to happen. And a lot of people, when they look at a teaser, is they look at a game that they like, and they're just taking that as insurance. And that's exactly the opposite of what you should do when you're playing teasers. When you're playing teasers, you're looking at numbers. You're not looking at games. Your handicapping is what you're doing. Your regular handicapping is what you're doing when you're looking at the games. These are a supplement, not a way to add to your handicap. And that's when people get in trouble. So you just basically, it's a separate bet. It has nothing to do with parlays. It has nothing to do with straight bets. It's just a separate bet where you're trying to cover key numbers in a game. And there's many games. For example, in the in that Jets-Jacksonville game, I'll tease Jacksonville down to 1.5, but I actually, from a betting standpoint, prefer the New York Jets side. But because of this low total in that game and because getting them down below a field goal, that is the mathematical way to play that game. And so I'm playing it on math, and if I decide to do something with the Jets, that's a totally different bet.
Now, when it comes to this Houston-Indianapolis game, maybe it's kind of fitting that we've got a reminder here, you know, we're just a few days removed from the start of fall, to change our batteries in the smoke detector. Because if you think about Houston here, there's a lot of smoke in Houston because Bill O'Brien's ass is burning. That seat is very, very hot right now for the Texans head coach. So how do you factor that into a handicap, Brian, where, you know, maybe they're not ready to move on from Bill O'Brien, but he certainly needs to start showing something here, especially when you talk about a division game against a first-year head coach. And, of course, you know, for Frank Reich, we would think that a first-year head coach now through 3 or 4 games would start improving a little bit, start getting a better feel for his roster. What do you do in that situation? Because we're going to have more of them this year where you've got coaches firmly on the hot seat. Is this something where, you know, it helps Houston that Bill O'Brien may be coaching for his job over the next couple of weeks? Does it hurt Houston because it's a distraction? How do you look at it in this particular situation, or how do you look at it overall?
Anytime there's a distraction, whether it's coaching, whether it's the hurricane coming, whether it's something that happened to one of the players, I always feel, and we saw it on, you know, it wasn't a big winner, but it did win Pittsburgh the other night. Everybody was counting out the Steelers. Everybody's talking about Tampa Bay and how much better they were. Anytime a team is being counted out, and there was a lot of times with the hurricane that just came through where teams were saying they were worried about what's going on back home. They can't be fully, they are fully focused on those games. And that's what the people just take up the narrative of they got other things on their mind. But if you're in that position, keep in mind, you can't control something that's, you know, it runs in everyday life. You know, for example, my wife will start bitching about things she can't control. I said, honey, you can't control that. Take that out of your mind. And that's the way these teams approach it. If a team says, you know, they say, well, what about the people being flooded out in your hometown? I can't control that. All I control is what we're doing on the football field that week. And I'm away from home for a week. And what's the worst thing that could happen? I lose the football game because I wasted half of my week worrying about something I couldn't control. So that is the team, kind of teams I want to bet on. I want to bet on the players, the Pittsburghs that are having all this off-field stuff going on. I want to bet on the coaches that are have their backs to the wall. I want to bet on those teams because if it's a coach that the players like, and it's hard to tell without being in the locker room, you can read the stories, and sports writers are not going to come out and say, you know, the players are really upset with this coach or whatever. But take a look at the Detroit Lions. After the first week, there was a lot of talk about the Detroit Lions not being happy with the coach. Then after the Lions beat New England last week, you go into the locker room, they're hugging them, they're crying. They love the coach. Well, nobody talked anything about that when this was going on a couple of weeks ago. So keep in mind, if there's any type of thing distracting, you would think would be distracting to the team, think of it the opposite and think this is a team that's going to gel for this week, gel for this coach, gel for these players who are trying to do something well for their home team. When there's so much going on back there, they want to get a win for their team, for their fans back home. So those are the type of things that I look at, and we've seen a lot of that when you've got these terrible things happen to the players, the shooting, something happens to one of the players, you know, one of their father dies or something. The teams rally around these players, and that's the type of thing that you can't judge by power ratings. Those are the kind of things that it's all an emotional type of setting. You know, we saw that back when the Saints had the big flood in New Orleans. What happened to the Saints? What it did for the community? We see it out here with the Las Vegas hockey team. Last year after 1 October, these emotional things are something that you want to take advantage of in handicapping. And it's just not the coaches. It's the whole city, everything going around them. So you got to be aware of what's happening each and every city. And it's really something that not a lot of people talk about, but it's a great emotional edge, and I love being on those type of teams.
All right, let's go to the Sunday night football game here then. Game 275-276, Baltimore takes on Pittsburgh. And look, I mean, this is a line that you can set without even really thinking too much about the game. It's going to be 3. Almost no matter what's happening with these two teams, the better team is going to be a 3-point favorite, or the home team is going to be a 3-point favorite, because historically, this is a very, very closely contested rivalry between AFC North teams. So Baltimore and Pittsburgh here on Sunday Night Football. Pittsburgh's a 3-point favorite. A little bit of extra juice here. A couple shops, including Pinnacle, have made the leap to 3.5. You mentioned Pittsburgh, and it seems like there's a lot of locker room turmoil. Now they're trying to trade Le'Veon Bell because they feel like James Conner has shown enough to be that guy. They don't want that Bell distraction. The players have kind of turned on him a little bit as well. Through it all, through the 0-1-1 start, through all the problems, through, you know, Ben Roethlisberger's usual drama queen bullshit, they won last week. And they beat Fitzmagic and slowed down the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And, Brian, I got to be honest with you. I'm a little bit surprised to not see more Pittsburgh investment here in this game, because when you get a team that does something like that in a premier spotlight, the first narrative everyone wants to come up with is, well, so-and-so is back. We're not seeing that really here in this game, I don't think.
Well, you got to keep in mind, Pittsburgh only won that game by 3. So even though they had the bigger lead, obviously, if people didn't watch the game, or even if they did watch it, they go, here come the Steelers again. They're going to blow this. And that's something you got to keep account of. But, you know, the Steelers were +3 in turnovers in that game. Anytime you're +3 in a game where it's lined like that, you should be winning more than 3 points. They did have a better successful play rate of 48-43% in that game, but I'm not sure the Steelers are back. And you got to keep in mind, this it's a short week for Pittsburgh, but there's probably nobody in the NFL that knows each other better than Baltimore and Pittsburgh. And you talked about the line basically being set at 3. I'll set the lines for you next year. I don't know who's going to be on the teams, but the lines are going to be 3 in each of these games, because that's just the way it is. But I am seeing some Pittsburgh money coming in now. 3 -120s in some places. So they are taking a little bit of money on Pittsburgh here. And anytime I see the line in these games approach a number other than 3, I take a sudden interest in the underdog because of the way these teams have played. My stats are showing basically that the teams have been pretty even on the season. When you take a look at what they've done, Baltimore's had a little bit lesser of a schedule because they did get to play Buffalo in that opening week. But Pittsburgh, other than Kansas City, who they gave up 59% successful plays against, which is just terrible, and 10 explosive plays, Pittsburgh's done pretty well in the other two games. But that's one thing I wanted to point out, was the explosive plays that this Pittsburgh defense has given up. There was a lot of talk, you know, especially now that we're both in Cleveland, we're both from Cleveland, and the new quarterback change in Cleveland. Well, when Pittsburgh played Cleveland earlier, Cleveland had 9 explosive plays. When Kansas City played, they had 10. Monday night, Tampa Bay had 8. So this Pittsburgh defense is still a team that gives up big plays in chunks. And now you got a Cleveland quarterback in there that's not afraid to throw the ball deep. And Baltimore is the same way. Baltimore is a team that they throw the ball a little bit deep. They got better receivers this year than they've had in the past. But Baltimore's a team that now is a little bit better offensively than they were in the last couple of years because of the receivers. And obviously, when you've got a team that recruits and signs a quarterback, number one draft choice, it puts a lot of pressure on Flacco. So he's picked up his game a little bit this year. I'm excited to see this game played. Normally, you would look for a low-scoring game here, but the total, as we've spoken, it's 51-51.5 here, that you'd never see that in a Pittsburgh-Baltimore game. Pittsburgh plays higher scoring games on the road than they do at home. They're more conservative at home. So we'll have to see how this one turns out. Right now I've got nothing on this game, but it's going to be obviously a beautiful game to watch, because that's what happens when Baltimore and Pittsburgh get together.
All right, we'll transition over to the college football side of things here. And Brian, I wanted to touch for a couple minutes from a power rating standpoint on some of your biggest adjustments here so far this year, because we've got three or four data points on every team out there now for the most part. A couple teams have only played two games because of postponements or bye weeks or things of that sort. Pretty much everybody's played three or four games here so far. So, you know, with the 13 weeks of college football, with the 16 weeks of the NFL, we have to make some pretty quick determinations about these teams because three or four games represents a pretty good sample size of the season. So as we head into week five here of the college football campaign, who are some of the biggest movers for you, whether it's up or down?
Well, I don't know the exact numbers of my moves offhand, but I will tell you that Alabama is a team that I've raised, and I never thought I have a chance to raise Alabama because I had them at number one in the country. Keep in mind, they have played a weaker schedule this year than most other teams, so they played a bunch of nobodies. But the Texas A&M line last week was inflated, and everybody knew it, and then they came in on game day and took that number out. And luckily, Texas A&M was able to get that back cover. But Alabama's been one. Appalachian State has looked really good this year. That's a team that I've raised. Arizona State, obviously, with the coaching change, there wasn't much expected there. Arkansas is a team that I've been betting the under on. This is basically taking them down under. Who would have thought they'd be a 30-point underdog in league play and they weren't playing Alabama or Georgia? This Arkansas team has major problems. And there's some others. You know, Baylor, I think, is a little bit better than what I thought they were going to be. But there's some teams, for example, you know, I stick with the MAC, and, you know, the MAC Bowling Green has been a team that hasn't played well, and I've had to drop them. Buffalo's a team that's looked really good, so I've had to raise them up. And then we're just going through the A's and B's. So there's a lot of work out here that you've got to make your adjustments on. And some of those teams that obviously Florida State comes to mind as the team that was thought of to be so much better. But, you know, as the season goes on, you're going to see Florida State get better and better. And they were better last week against Northern Illinois. Although the Huskies don't have much of an offense, they do have a pretty good defense. And Florida State is just a team that will get better as they get used to this new system. You know, for example, Kent State's one of the games on the board this week. They haven't wowed everybody, but they've got a new system in which they're going faster. Well, when they play a team like Penn State, playing faster means playing more plays. And when you're the lesser team and you're playing more plays against the better team, that's a bad situation. And that was what happened with Penn State. Penn State pulled away late in that game. But yeah, you really got to make your adjustments up and down. And, you know, some teams look good after one or two games. And then you just got to realize that, okay, well, it's different than it has been. And for a lot of times, you know, we're getting to the point now where we're finally getting into league games and conference games. So you have to take it with a different look because certain teams will just throw away the early games. They don't want to get anybody hurt. You're playing, you know, you're a 30-point underdog. You're not going to win those games. So the coaches will say, okay, well, let's try to play as many people as we can, try to learn a little bit from our team. We see the same thing in exhibition games when you're looking at the NFL and college basketball, excuse me, NFL and the NBA. There's a lot of that going on. So once you get into league action, there's certain teams that turn it on in league action. So you've got to treat it a little bit differently. So you don't want to make too many over adjustments. You got to know a little bit about the history of these coaches and what they're trying to prove.
Yeah, I mean, I think as I'm going through here and looking at some of my adjustments and looking at some of my numbers, I would say on average the biggest adjustments that I've made are in the 6.5-point range. Alabama's up 5.5 points for me, which is absolutely insane because you would never expect Alabama to be that much of an increase for you. But they're all the way up to 102 in my power ratings. They open 96.5. You know, Ohio's a team I've moved down 6 points. Buffalo's a team I've moved up about 6.5 points. So, you know, generally in that 6, 6.5 range. And it's one of those things where, you know, early on in the year, you don't want to over-adjust. You don't want to take yourself out of, you know, all that preseason work that you did in the summertime. I think now is about the time where you can start to admit, you know, maybe I was wrong about this team. Maybe I was too low. Maybe I was too high. And if you don't end up doing that, then you wind up with numbers that are way off from the market. And again, you want your power ratings. While you want some positions on teams, you really, by and large, want a lot of these numbers to come out close to what the market has, so that you know that you're evaluating these teams properly.
Yeah, that's correct. There's guys out there that use computer models, and they'll even be on Twitter, and they'll, you know, after the first week, they'll say, okay, well, this is 90% last season along with 10% of this season. Then, like now I've seen where it's gotten to the point where it's like a 50-50 this year compared to last year, 57% this year, 43% last year. And two of the major that I made was obviously Hawaii. Hawaii's been a team that came out of nowhere. Then Nebraska. Nebraska is a team right now that is similar to Florida State, where they've got a new system in there, they got a new coach, and they're doing things differently. And I don't think anybody expected Nebraska and Florida State, obviously, to start off and struggle the way they have because of the athletes that they get in there. But those are two that you definitely would have had to make some major adjustments on, or you're just not in the same ballpark, because there's been, you know, both of those teams have moved. I know Hawaii's moved double digits, so at least for myself, and that's something that you have to move quickly on. In the beginning of the season, you're playing one-on-one, so when Hawaii plays an SMU or something, you don't know who to move. Is it the SMU or the Hawaii? But now that you've got three or four games in there, you got a pretty good idea of, okay, it was Hawaii that's so much better. SMU is more like what we thought they were going to be.
All right, let's talk about a trio of MAC games here real quickly, and we'll start with game 115-116. Northern Illinois takes on Eastern Michigan. Eastern Michigan up to a 3.5-point favorite here in this game, and you know, Eastern Michigan's played very well here the last 3 weeks. They beat Purdue, played Buffalo tough. That was a game that probably could have gone either way down the wire there. Then, of course, played San Diego State extremely tough in a very unique travel situation. For Northern Illinois, though, I mean, they've played Iowa, Utah, and Florida State. And while Florida State's not a good team this season, they're still a lot more talented than Northern Illinois. So this is a very intriguing game to me. And you get some of these in week four, week five, week six, where you've got some pretty noticeable strength of schedule differences. What do you think about this game, Brian? And what do you think about the line move going up from 3 to 3.5?
I can understand it. I've been higher on Northern Illinois. I came into the season, I thought they were the best team in the MAC. And obviously, as of this point, I'm wrong. But things could change. And once you get into conference action, they are 1-0 in conference. They ended up beating Central Michigan. Did not cover in that game. But when you take a look at successful play rate in those games that Northern Iowa played, they had 34.8% offensive success against Iowa, only allowed 32.8%. So they actually played very well in that game. Utah, they lost 37.1 to 34.2. So in those first two games, they actually played really well. Didn't show up on the scoreboard. Part of that, when they played Iowa, they lost the turnover battle. And then they lost the sack battle 5-1, which is why they lost by 26 points. But when they go in and they played Central Michigan and Florida State the last 2 weeks, the offense has actually gotten worse, and the defense has been basically the same. So Northern Illinois is all about the defense. If they can slow down this Eastern Michigan team, they can compete in this game. And Eastern Michigan, other than the game when they played Buffalo, which where they were close to the league average, they had a 33.9 against Purdue, 34.9 against San Diego State. Those are two teams that they didn't move the ball very well against, but you know, they were able to play pretty well and get the victory against Purdue and go to overtime against San Diego State. And I'll be honest, I had San Diego State in that game. I thought that was a terrible situation for Eastern Michigan. Third straight road game, having to travel all the way to the West Coast. They hadn't played in the Pacific time zone in at least 20 years. And they lose a turnover battle and still cover that game. That was an impressive game against San Diego State. But now, after three straight road games, they got to fly all the way back home to Northern Illinois. Then they got to go back on the road and play Western Michigan. So the schedule is definitely better for Northern Illinois, who is actually in the middle of a three-game road trip. This is the second game, Florida State, Eastern Michigan, and then Ball State. I don't trust Northern Illinois at this point enough to play them because that offense has done absolutely nothing. But I won't be on Eastern Michigan because of the travel and the situation that they are in. This is going to be one of those games that I'll be just sitting out.
We'll move one spot down on the board here. Game 117-118, that's Kent State and Ball State. Kent State plus 7.5 in this spot, pretty much the consensus number out there market-wide, a couple of places showing 7 with extra juice. I don't know what to think about this game, Brian. I will say that from a power rating standpoint, I grabbed Kent State at the open. We'll see how that ends up playing out for me here. The big takeaway for me in this game is that I think Ball State has been a significant disappointment so far.
They have, but if you take a look at the MAC as a whole, excuse me, as a whole, the whole conference has been a disappointment. I actually have the Kent team, based on my power ratings, with a 4.3 higher schedule. So they played the tougher schedule. Keep in mind they played Illinois, but when they did play Illinois, Illinois had, I think, 13 players out, six of them starters. So, but they did play Illinois well in that game, and was they lost the turnover battle and still covered. That's something I always take a look at. In fact, Kent State's 2-0 in games. They lose the turnover battle and cover the spread. Those are usually teams that I'm looking to bet on. Those are teams that are under the radar. And I actually did take Kent State at 7.5 because I got a feeling this thing's going to close at 6.5. So I did play them earlier. But this is Kent's third straight road game, Penn State, Mississippi, Ball State. And I talked about how they play at a faster pace. When you're playing the Penn States and the Mississippis, two teams with really good offenses, that's not a great thing to do. And they allowed 101 combined points in those games. But now they're playing the Ball State team that is back down to their level. I've got Ball State probably about 3 points better here on a neutral, which would be probably, you know, 5.5, 6 in this game, which is why I played them. But, you know, Ball State, that game against Notre Dame, the Irish clearly looked past Ball State. That was a major sandwich situation for them. A lot of people bought into Ball State based on that game, and I wasn't one of them. Then they go in to play Indiana. They lose that game by 28. There was no turnover advantage in that game. So that one played out probably the way it should, so they didn't cover. Then last week's game against Western Kentucky, a lot of people are really down on Ball State because of Western Kentucky in that game. But I could see the reason for it. If you're taking a look at successful plays, they give up 48% successful plays, only had 43.2 themselves. Didn't have a turnover advantage. Sacks were exact 1-to-1. They just didn't play very well. And the defense has played decently well for Ball State considering the competition they played. The offense, decent with the way they played. But this is a team, you know, offensively, they've only been able to put up 36 points in three games against FBS schools. And only one of them would be an elite team, and that would be Notre Dame. So I took the points with Kent State. I just think based on the way these teams have played and the major letdown from going from, you know, a 91 and a 76 down to a 57 in power ratings for Kent State, I think that's definitely going to help them here, whereas Ball State played a team in the Kent State area last week in Western Kentucky, and they were only given 3 in that game, and they didn't play very well. So Ball State could have a bounce back here, but I just think at this point that getting over touchdown with Kent is the way to go in this game.
One more team I want to touch on specifically rather than look at the game, because we've seen a pretty big line move in game 157-158, Western Michigan, Miami of Ohio. Second straight week that Western Michigan has been hammered out there in the market. They got bet up significantly against Georgia State last week into the -8 range on the road. I think they opened 5.5 or 6 in that game. Now it looks like they're going to close a road favorite in Oxford against Miami of Ohio. Are you seeing what the market is seeing here? Have you been on this Western Michigan train and adjusting them up?
I haven't adjusted them up, and that's because the lines have been basically what I had them as. Against Georgia State, my closing number was 7.5. My number on the game was 7.5. So I just think it was opened a little bit too low. And keep in mind, when they come up with these opening lines, two $500 bets later, the lines are moving. So it didn't take long for that game to get to 7.5, and it basically stayed 7.5, 8 for most of the week. But against Michigan, it was 27.5. I had the game, and it moved up to 28. But that was more of a situation where people looking to back Michigan a little bit in that game. So I'm not buying into the people are buying into the Western Michigan. I just think the opening lines were a little bit off, and then they settled in basically where I thought they would settle in. You know, Western plays Syracuse, Michigan, and Georgia State. Major drop down in its class last week, and obviously it showed. And they went from a 94 team in Michigan to a 53 team in Georgia State, and they took it out on them after playing a pretty good Syracuse team, which I have at 75. So they did drop down to play the lesser team, and they took advantage of them. They were +3 in turnover, which always helps, and they were 4-0 in the sack department. This Western Michigan team is playing basically what I thought they would. The opening game, I had them against Syracuse. They lost that turnover battle. They deserved to lose that game. They had a late comeback a little bit, but Syracuse has been better than what I thought they were. So Western Michigan is basically what they thought they were. You know, they're playing Miami this week, and Miami finally got a game where they didn't have to play in a storm and the bad weather, and they looked a little bit better. But, yeah, this is a game I'm probably not going to be involved in either. It's just one of those that I think is lying pretty close to where it should be.
Brian Leonard, professional handicapper from WagerTalk.com. What do you guys got going on over there, Brian?
WagerTalk, it's video day. You know, we're having a lot of success on these videos. They're getting really talked about on the internet. A lot of people love them, so we get as many out there as possible. So I'll be going in there today with probably five or six other handicappers than Kelly in Vegas, who's very popular with the guys out there that like to watch videos. It's amazing how many more views we get now that we got a pretty girl in our studio. So I guess they're fed up with our fat guys, me, Rolf, and Marco D'Angelo out there, but at least they get to look at Kelly. But, yeah, we've got a lot of good information, and we're doing that today, and can't wait. We've got a lot of big-name games that maybe we don't cover in our segments here. You know, we're talking about the MAC that we do talk about on those videos. We try to take the biggest and best games of the weekend. So if you want to get a look at some of those games that are going to be on TV and you'd like to watch, check into the videos at WagerTalk DP and WagerTalk.com.
And you can follow Brian on Twitter at BLeonardSports. Brian, appreciate your time as always, sir. Get that battery changed, and we'll talk to you again next week.
I'll do it. I appreciate it. Good luck to everyone.
Good stuff there on today's program, covering NFL and college football there with Brian Leonard of WagerTalk.com. We got one more guest here for this Wednesday edition of the show. That is Wes Reynolds at Wes Reynolds, the number one on Twitter. Wes, how's it going today, man?
Adam, doing well. How about yourself, sir?
Doing very well. Appreciate your time here. Thank you for sticking on hold for a couple minutes there as well. I certainly appreciate that. And Wes, you know what? Let's go ahead and break up the football a little bit here. And let's start by talking about the Ryder Cup. We had a very good segment yesterday with Brian Blessing about some different betting angles to look at here. This one, of course, at Le Golf National over in France. U.S. hasn't won the Ryder Cup on European soil since 1993. So let's go ahead and answer that question first. Does the U.S. win this thing this year?
You know, I did not bet them. I haven't necessarily bet against them. I think the price value, if you're just looking strictly from that standpoint, is with the Europeans. I mean, we know breaking down the individuals of the team, the U.S. probably has the talent edge. It's not a huge overwhelming edge, though. But, I mean, if you average the official world golf ranking of the American players, it averages out to be a little over 11 and change. And if you average it out for the European players, it's about 19 and change. But I think that they are favorites for a couple different reasons. Number one, the process, obviously, in terms of picking the team, in terms of the team chemistry, in terms of having more guys invested in the Ryder Cup program, you know, kind of like, well, the Europeans had been for so many years. That's clearly there for Team USA. And so I think that's one reason. Another reason is if you look at the players and you look at the big tournaments this year, three of the four majors were won by Americans. Three of the four WGCs were won by Americans. The Players' Championship was won by an American, Webb Simpson. And also, all four FedEx Cup events, including three by guys that are playing on the Ryder Cup team, were won by the Americans. So, I mean, they've come up bigger in the big events this year. But I do think that that gives value, and that's kind of the million-dollar question is the American talent slight edge enough to overcome the course edge at Le Golf National? Because you know that this is going to be set up differently. It's going to be set up. It's going to be narrow fairways. There's a lot of water. There's also a lot of holes where you don't really hit driver. And that negates a big American advantage because I think they have a few more bigger hitters than the Europeans. So, and you're also going to have some high rough, and they're going to penalize you if you're not striking the ball well on this course. And, I mean, you have a lot of Americans that have not played this course, even though the fact that it is an event that hosts a regular European Tour event, you had one player for the U.S. team go over and play, and it was Justin Thomas. And you also have a guy on the European team that did win on this course back in July, and Alex Noren was the winner of the Open de France right on this course. So, you know, I mean, a lot of U.S. money came over 2 weeks because they seemed like they were, you know, dominating these FedEx Cup events, but you've seen some buyback on Europe. I think the price is probably fair now, where you're maybe getting like a 150 to plus 130 or a 145 to 125.
Well, of course, too, not just Alex Noren winning it this year, but 2 years ago in 2016, Tommy Fleetwood won on this course. So you've got two past winners here at the Golf National on this European tour or European Ryder Cup team. So, you know, let me ask you about this year, because I think a lot is going to be made of the stress of this tournament. And we talked about this yesterday with Brian Blessing in that, you know, you're not really playing your game necessarily, especially when it comes to the foursome match. You're playing your partner's game because you have to set your partner up for the next shot. So this match play team format thing is a little bit different. We did see the Zurich Classic played like this during the PGA Tour tournament season, which was a difference for that tournament. But, you know, we've got some guys here that are rookies. We've got three rookies on the U.S. team in Justin Thomas, Bryson DeChambeau, Tony Finau, but there are five rookies on the European team. So because this isn't a stroke play format, because this isn't an every man for himself format, what do you think about the experience differences here between the two teams? Do you feel like that's an actionable thing from maybe a matchup standpoint?
I mean, it very well could be, depending on the layout of a particular matchup. Now, when you look at all these rookies, I mean, these are not way down there rookies. I mean, you know, these are not Brett Wedericks or Paul Ulrich Johansson. These are not no names. These are guys that have all won tournaments. I mean, Finau has only won one. That was an alternate event down in Puerto Rico. But you know, he has the class. He's a top 20 player. He's consistent. I mean, all eight of these rookies on these sides are very good players and guys that have won big time events against good fields. And have kind of shown their mettle. So I don't think any of these guys are really going to be intimidated or scared by the experience. I mean, I think it's putting them with the right guys. And I mean, I've kind of been monitoring over the last couple of days, and both Captain Furyk and Bjorn may be playing some mind games. I mean, just because you send them out in a practice round doesn't mean you're necessarily going to pair them together. But like, you look on the U.S. side, you've seen Tiger and Patrick Reed together, which, you know, a lot of people were thinking, well, wait a minute, you know, Patrick Reed and Jordan Spieth have kind of been your A-team over the last couple years. But, you know, this could be an experiment on the first day, too, if they change it up a little bit, because, you know, you can always go back to that pairing. I mean, certain pairings you know are going to be together. Like, you know that Justin Rose and Henrik Stenson will probably play together in the four ball because, I mean, they're best friends. They used to be next door neighbors down in Orlando at Lake Nona. So you're going to see those guys probably play together, but then you'll see them change in the foursomes. Like, you may have Fleetwood and Poulter, let's say, in the four ball, and then you'll have Rose and Poulter in the alternate shot, and you'll have Fleetwood with maybe somebody like Paul Casey or somebody like that in the alternate shot. And I think, you know, a lot of it is momentum to see how it goes. Certain guys, you know, on these teams are probably going to end up playing all five sessions. I mean, I would expect Rory McIlroy is going to play all five matches. I would expect Justin Rose is going to play all five matches. And a lot of it depends on if you're ahead or you're behind. I would expect probably Brooks Koepka, who played four matches as a rookie last time before he won three majors, is probably going to play five matches. I would expect maybe they send Justin Thomas or DJ out there for five matches. But that's the trick when looking at these things. You got to look at the guys who are going to play a lot. I mean, even Tiger in his great form and has been the story of golf, his resurgence, this is his first Ryder Cup in 6 years. How many matches is he going to play? Is he really going to go out and play all five sessions? And I'm not convinced of that.
Well, that's an important thing. And that was one of the notes that we made on yesterday's show. I think I actually said it specifically, is that if you're looking at the prop betting market here for the top scorer, whether it's by team or the top scorer overall, you want to make sure you're getting somebody that's going to play all five sessions, because you really want the opportunity to get as many of those points as possible. And I mean, you know, last year, at Hazeltine, rookie Thomas Peters was actually the overall top scorer, Patrick Reed, of course, for Team USA. So, you know, again, that's something that's very important that you want to take a look at here. And let's kind of talk about that for a second here. We'll look at Team USA specifically first. The guy that I like the most here to be the top scorer is Justin Thomas. I mean, Justin Thomas is a great player. He was just probably too young to be on that Ryder Cup team 2 years ago, not experienced enough. Over the last 2 years, there aren't many players that have been as good or as successful as Justin Thomas. Also, the only member of the U.S. Ryder Cup team to play at Le Golf National in that Open de France this year. So Thomas is my pick for the top scorer from Team USA. I also think he does play all five matches because he's a really reliable player that doesn't have any weakness in his game. That means something in the four ball and the foursome, as far as I'm concerned. Who would you take as the top scorer from the U.S., and you know, why are you looking to go that route?
Well, Thomas is a guy I definitely looked at. I went a little bit down the board here because I think sometimes we look at recent form a little bit too much in an event like this, because you obviously do that week to week when we're betting tournaments on the tour every week. But here is a totally different animal, and Thomas would definitely be on my short list. I think that's a good pick on your part. I went a little bit down the board and took Ricky Fowler. And people are going to be listening to this and be like, what the hell are you doing taking Ricky Fowler? He's only got a 2-4-5 record in the Ryder Cup. But I think that oblique injury maybe could have been a blessing in disguise for him, because it forced him to take a couple weeks off. I mean, you recall these guys had like 1 week off when they, you know, most of them didn't play the Wyndham Championship down in Greensboro. But, I mean, these guys were going hardcore, you know, to the event at Firestone, the PGA, all four of the FedEx Cup events. And Ricky, of course, took the first two events off to rest and get his injury settled. And I think he, you know, that's probably a blessing for him. I think he's going to be a little bit more well-rested than some of his fellow players and his competitors. And I also think he's probably at least, you know, you don't necessarily have to play five matches, but I think you at least have to play four. And I could definitely see Ricky playing four. And I think his past record here gives him a little bit of value. And he's obviously a self-motivated guy. I mean, this is all about the team. But he's self-motivated because, obviously, he didn't get a win this year, even though he had a very good season. A lot of top fives, a lot of top tens. But he didn't get in the winner's circle this season. So, you know, maybe this is the way to kind of cap off his season, is to get a bunch of points for this Ryder Cup team. So I went with Ricky. He's about, you know, like I think I got him at plus 950s. Anywhere you might see him in the 8-1 range, you might see him in the 10-1 range. So I think that he's a guy under the radar a little bit for the Americans.
All right, so let's go over to the European side here. And as I mentioned, you've got five rookies on the European Ryder Cup team. They are Tyrrell Hatton, Tommy Fleetwood, John Rahm, Alex Noren, and then Thorbjørn Olesen. So those are your five rookies there. The seven guys with Ryder Cup experience, though, have a combined record in this thing of 61, 40, and 23. You take Francesco Molinari out of the equation, and it's 61, 36, and 21. Ian Poulter, Justin Rose, Sergio Garcia, all very, very good in their past Ryder Cup appearances. Rory McIlroy, only 9, 6, and 4, but you know, Rory tends to draw a lot of really, really tough matchups as well. So who are you looking at on the European side, Wes, to maybe lead this team in points?
Or going to be like, what the hell is he doing picking this guy when they listen to this? And I went with a guy who's never won a Ryder Cup match and who has played in Ryder Cups, and that's Francesco Molinari, who is 0-4-2. So he's never gotten a full point for any of his European sides in the past, but he's never been the player that he's been right now. I mean, this was a career year. He had been steadily kind of moving to this over the last year or two. And I mean, this is a guy, if Brooks Koepka didn't win two majors, and they haven't named this yet, but he's going to be player of the year winning two majors. I think that's hard to not give it to him. But the guy that I think would have been second was Molinari. I mean, here's a guy that won the Open Championship. He was the only European to win a major this year, won his first event on the PGA Tour at the AT&T National, almost won the John Deere Classic, and also won the European Tour's kind of flagship event at the BMW PGA. And the reason why I like Molinari here is I think he sets up well on this course because he's not a short hitter, but he's not a long hitter, but he's a straight hitter. And he's a guy that I don't think gets phased under adversity, which is why I think you're seeing him paired with Tyrrell Hatton in some of these practice rounds. I could see them playing together on that first day because it's a total contrast. It's the calm, steady Eddie of Molinari and kind of the hothead temper of the very talented Tyrrell Hatton. So, you know, maybe that's kind of an opposite the track type of thing. And I think Molinari is going to get overlooked because obviously Rose and McIlroy should be the favorites because they're likely to play five matches. But like you said with Rory, they're going to get tough matchups. I mean, they're not going to, I think, draw, you know, maybe you can't really call a weakest player on the American team, but I mean, they're probably not going to draw Tony Finau in singles. You know, these guys are probably going to draw Patrick Reed or Jordan Spieth or a Justin Thomas or a Brooks Koepka, you know, some, you know, one of their the American more top players. And I could see Molinari maybe drawing a middle guy. And I think, you know, when you got a guy that hasn't won a Ryder Cup point, he knows that. And I think he knows that while he has talent on this team, that these guys are still rookies. So I think Molinari is going to feel not necessarily pressure per se. I don't know if that's the right word, but he's going to know that he has responsibility to bring home points. And as one of the few real veterans on this team. And I think he's really good value at around, he's around ballpark around 10 to 1. I've seen him as low as 8 to 1. But I think this guy, you know, is pretty steady. He's not phased. I think he's a different player, and that affects your mindset. You know, he's a guy that knows he can win big tournaments. He's a guy that knows he can come up big in big moments, as he's done all season. And I think he's got good value down the board.
If I had to take a guy from the European side here, there are a couple that I kind of had my eye on, both of them rookies, interestingly enough. I think John Rahm is a guy that could really shine here in this event. I mean, you look at what the rookies did at Hazeltine 2 years ago. I mentioned already Thomas Peters, most points overall. He was 4-1. Rafael Cabrera-Bello was 2-0-1 in his three matchups. I think John Rahm is a guy, you know, and I've seen some talk that maybe John Rahm gets paired with Rory McIlroy just to kind of, you know, calm him down maybe a little bit, or at least let him ride the excitement of Rory McIlroy. You could also see John Rahm with somebody like Sergio Garcia, which makes a whole lot of sense. Garcia, very steady guy, lots of experience in this. So I think John Rahm, at least when it comes to the potential team events, I think he's going to be paired with a couple of guys that, you know, wind up fitting really well. And of course, you know, I mean, all these guys are world-class players, but if he gets the chance to play with Rory, you certainly have to appreciate that for him. Also, I think, you know, you've got this young, brash type of guy in Rahm who knows how talented he is, has the chance to go out there and show it on a big stage. It worked for the rookies in 2016. I think maybe it works for Rahm here. And it's also kind of a similar type of mindset to maybe take a look at a guy like Tommy Fleetwood, who, you know, I know in the middle of the year in PGA Tour events, a lot of people were tipping Fleetwood. He was in the 20 to 30 to 1 range. Didn't do a whole lot at the tail end of the season here. But Fleetwood's another one of those guys that, you know, I think is just kind of, I don't want to say lying in the weeds, but another one of those young, brash, aggressive, don't give any Fs kind of players that, you know, a lot of times in the Ryder Cup, you kind of want that type of guy who's going to go out there and instead of trying not to lose it, going to actively try to win it. And of course, you know, if he's paired with somebody like an Ian Poulter, who's been very, very good in the Ryder Cup, Fleetwood can kind of ride those coattails as well.
Yeah, a couple interesting things that you pointed out about Rahm. You know, number one, I think those two, the two players that you mentioned are the guys he's going to be paired with. If you look at, first of all, Rory is a guy that he doesn't necessarily have that partner that he's been with consistently all these years. He's played with a lot of different partners. And you saw he played with the rookie Thomas Peters and how really good Thomas Peters was in the last Ryder Cup, which is why I thought he maybe had more of a chance to make this team than most. But I think you're going to see Rory potentially and probably with Rahm at some point. I think you'll also see him with Tjorborg and Olesen, who's another rookie, because these captains, and you know, they keep the continuity, and both teams have done this, where they keep the captains from before, the assistant captains, you know, that have some say and have some influence over the matchups. And the Europeans have traditionally tried to put Rory with a young guy where it's like, we got a young guy, he doesn't have a lot of experience at this, let's put him with Rory, and, you know, to kind of keep the ball. And I could also see Rahm with Sergio, and you know, maybe they make an attempt there to try to recreate that old Seve Ballesteros, Jose Maria Olazabal magic, who were the greatest pair ever in the history of the Ryder Cup with an 11-2-2 record. You know, you have an older Spaniard with a younger Spaniard, even though the age discrepancy is maybe about 5 years bigger with Sergio and Rom than it was with Seve and Jose Maria. But I am with you on Rom, and I think he could get a little underlooked because, you know, he has not really killed it to finish the season here. I mean, he started off pretty well at the Tour Championship, then kind of faded a little bit. But, you know, you don't want to look too much at recent form. I mean, because guys come out of nowhere. I mean, how many times have we seen Ian Poulter kind of have not a very good year, not even a year where he didn't even win anything, and then all of a sudden comes Ryder Cup time and he's almost unbeatable. And he's like 12-4-1 or 12-4-2, I think, is his all-time Ryder Cup record. So, I mean, you've seen that a lot. So I do think these rookies are going to play better. And one thing with these European rookies to keep in mind, yeah, they're rookies, but they're five rookies that have won a combined 28 worldwide events, and the average age of these five guys is 28 years old. So these are not scrubs. These are really good players on that European side, including Thorbjørn Olesen, who is a several-time winner on the European Tour. So you don't want to look at those names and kind of say, well, I don't know how good these guys are. These guys are really good.
Now, let me ask you this here, and we'll just do this across both teams, and then we'll spend a few minutes talking about football. Are there any guys in this Ryder Cup field that you're looking to fade from a matchup standpoint?
Yeah, that's a tough call. I mean, I would say Brooks Koepka because, I mean, he did go 3-1 last time, but I wonder with a couple of these top American players. Now, of course, Jordan Spieth did not make the Tour Championship, so maybe he gets pushed a little bit down the radar a little bit and could, in fact, play a little better than people expect. But a couple of the top American guys, and I think it's very balanced with talent, so there's enough guys to pick up the slack, but I think maybe a Dustin Johnson, you know, he's back to world number one. I think maybe he's a guy that could be a favorite that you could go against where he's laying like $1.70 or $1.80 or $2 in a match. And he's a guy maybe you could find a way to go against, especially if he plays the alternate shot. I think him and Koepka are a very formidable four-ball team, and they're gym buddies and training partners. And I think they're real comfortable in something where, you know, you just got to make a bunch of birdies. But I think a guy like Johnson, you know, maybe he can get a little wayward with his driver. You know, there's a couple guys that can, even though his ball striking statistics were really good this year. But I think there's an opportunity to maybe go against him. So not necessarily that he'll play bad, but just because he'll be a little overpriced. On the European side, I think people are going to want to go against Sergio Garcia. I would say buyer beware in doing that. You know, don't just put him down for an automatic fade, even though he's had a terrible year. He did finish seventh last week at the Portugal Masters and played the tune-up event. You know, Sergio lives for this Ryder Cup, and he's 2.5 points away from tying Nick Faldo for the all-time European points getter in the history of the event. So, you know, Sergio Garcia is a guy you don't make a lot of money necessarily betting against in the Ryder Cup. But I guess if I were to look at a European player maybe to go against, there is the potential of Henrik Stenson simply because of his health. His ball striking statistics, and we've talked about it in past podcasts, you know, number one in accuracy, number one in greens in regulation. But with those kind of stats, he never really came close to winning this year, which makes me think that he does have some injury issues. And I mean, you know, he's the Iceman and he's a great player, and he's a better player than I think he's given credit for, but he's 7-7-2 all time in the Ryder Cup. So, you know, not necessarily the greatest record, not necessarily the worst record, but I wonder about his health. Now, him and Justin Rose are a tough combination to beat. Plays with somebody else, you know, he's maybe a little more gettable.
Yeah, I think there are a few guys you can look to go against here. One guy, and again, this is very not easy to do given how Patrick Reed played in 2016, But Patrick Reed did not play well down the stretch at all whatsoever. In fact, he was probably coming into the Ryder Cup here, probably in the worst form of anybody on Team USA. Maybe you could put Phil Mickelson in that group, I guess. But Patrick Reed did not play well down the stretch. Got to be a little bit worried about him here. Also, I think a guy like Bubba Watson, who can get erratic off the tee. And as you mentioned, this is a place where you're going to get penalized for being erratic off the tee. Where somebody like Phil Mickelson's kind of made his hay later in his career as sort of a scrambler and kind of a, you know, improvisational player. A little bit worried about Bubba Watson and his ability to do that, particularly if he's put in a team event where he's erratic off the tee, puts somebody into that real thick rough. I think that's something that would be real problematic for Team USA. So Bubba Watson's a guy that worries me a little bit. And I'll echo your sentiments about Stenson when it comes to the European side, which could also mean some fades of Justin Rose, who is a very, very good player, just, you know, won $10 million for the FedEx Cup. And of course, a guy who's been very good in the Ryder Cup. But if he's paired with Stenson, you know, the Stenson health is a concern. Also, you know, Stenson's not getting any younger, and he's been playing quite a few events here to try and get back into form. So I'll echo that one with you there with Henrik Stenson. I think that's a good guy to possibly look to go against here. And you know, as we wrap up our Ryder Cup coverage here on the show, I do want to say, I understand that this isn't the most exciting market for a lot of people. Maybe it's not a market that you've, you know, taken a dive into all that often. But I think because of the unique format for this event, and I'm sure Wes will echo this when I finish up my point here, because this is so matchup and prop driven, maybe a lot more so than betting the regular PGA Tour and European Tour events, I think there are a lot more opportunities to make money. We talk about diversifying your portfolio on this show. I think when it comes to the Ryder Cup, with the unique nature, with how you can compare strengths and weaknesses for the teammates, stuff like that, I think there are so many more opportunities here that it was good to spend, you know, a decent part of two segments here on the show about the Ryder Cup.
Yeah, exactly. And one thing to be advised, especially for some of the West Coast listeners of the Bang the Book podcast, is that, you know, you're going to have to get up early to play some of these bets, especially when they have a morning session that's usually put out the night before. And then before that first session ends, they're putting out the afternoon session matches. And, you know, I had heard from Jeff Sherman over at the Westgate, who goes at Golf Odds on Twitter. Some of these matchups, they're not going to be able to get up at the book that they will have on their app simply because the book is not open when some of these matchups are going to go off. So, I mean, you know, there are actually books that close for a few hours out here to, and then have to come in the morning and set odds and whatnot and get prices up on the LED screen. But, you know, that's one thing to kind of be aware of. Probably because of the time of the year with the NFL and college football going on gets ignored, but there are opportunities here. And even if you only bet a couple matchups, this is a really fun event to watch. This is arguably the most talented Ryder Cup in history. This is the first time, actually, I believe in Ryder Cup history, players in the official world golf rankings playing in the event, which makes sense because in the past years you've had tons of Australian players, Vijay Singh from Fiji, guys from South Africa. So you've had non-US and non-European players up in that top 10. And for the first time, you don't have that here for a Ryder Cup. So I think that this is going to be a really fun watch and a really competitive event. And, you know, hope everybody at least gets involved in watching the event.
So basically what you're saying, Wes, is you're not getting much sleep this weekend.
More than likely not.
All right, let's transition over to the NFL side of things here, because I want to spend a few minutes talking about derivative betting, which is something that you have a lot of success with. You are a very, very high volume handicapper at Wes Reynolds on the number one on Twitter. If you follow him, you know that he's a very high volume handicapper. So we talked in the previous segment with Brian Leonard about inflated NFL totals and what they're doing from a teaser standpoint. I want to ask you, what are these inflated totals doing for you from a derivative standpoint?
Well, I think you've been able to find a little bit of value, especially maybe going over in some of the first halves. I used to like to go under, but even, you know, games, and I'm not even talking about where you have the two big offenses like you had with the Chargers and the Rams. You know, I'm talking like a Denver and Baltimore. I mean, that thing went over the first half total last week, because I played the first half over 20 or 23. That thing went over by the first quarter. And
you know, two teams that you wouldn't expect would be in like an offensive shootout. So you're seeing that, and I also think you're seeing books try to get ahead and try to adjust because just so many of either the rule changes or the rule enforcements or so many penalties being called. I mean, we saw on Monday night when you had four roughing the passer calls in a half with the Steelers and the Buccaneers. And the total roughing the passer penalties have actually doubled from this time last year. And a lot of it is the addition of the, you can't land your body weight on the quarterback or whatnot. And they are really, they're protecting these quarterbacks at an all-time high. So obviously the more penalties you get, the more you're going to see, I think, points because you're going to see drives extended. And these are 15-yard penalties, not 5-yard encroachment penalties. So when you add that to the pass interference, spot foul rule, and, you know, quarterbacks now are being taught to throw it up and see if they can draw a penalty where you can get 40, 50-yard pass interference penalties. And I think that's probably inflating the scoring. Now, eventually the numbers adjust. I don't know when that's going to happen. It could be this week. It could take a few more weeks. Eventually they adjust the numbers enough and they, it regresses back to the mean. But I just think the game, mainly the way the game's being officiated is what's kind of affecting these numbers. It's not necessarily that the offenses are just so more explosive.
Now, when we talk specifically about second halves here, you know, one team is going to be trailing more often than not. You know, you may have a tie game late in the fourth quarter, and that certainly does happen. But one team is going to be trailing more often than not. So obviously they're going to be trying to throw the football so that they stop the clock and incompletions and get yards in bigger chunks. You know, we talk about running out the clock. That's more of a college thing to me because in the NFL, teams are just going to run their offenses. They're going to do what they do, what has given them success, what has gotten them there. So we probably do see some more throwing in the second half. And I don't have that quantifiable statistic in front of me, just kind of what I would expect the case to be in the second half. So do you find yourself gravitating more towards the over in second halves because of, you know, the expectation of more throwing attempts, which also this year means the expectation of more penalties?
You know, a little bit more. I mean, it depends, I think, on how high the score is. I mean, we kind of saw that a little bit with Pittsburgh and Tampa Bay, where the score was 30-10 at halftime, but the Steelers you know, I believe the final score, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't have my log in front of me, I believe was 30-27. And I mean, there was only like, I think, there couldn't have been more than 20 points scored in the second half because Pittsburgh, I know, didn't score hardly. So, I mean, so that would lead you towards taking an under. And, you know, and I think with college, especially what we see on some of these bad beats, you have a lot of these, some reason, are very averse to taking a knee late in the game. We saw it in one of the worst bad beats you'll see with the Miami of Ohio Bowling Green total, where Bowling Green has no timeouts. Miami's up 31-17, total 55.5. They could take a knee, run out the clock, but they run it twice and get in for a touchdown, and there's 30 seconds left, some second and change. Bowling Green, of course, you know, they're going to try to throw down the field. They didn't try to run out the clock and be like, okay, the game's over. We're down 3 touchdowns. So they throw a long one. They get a pass interference, and it goes down to a Hail Mary on the last play, and they score a touchdown. It's a tip ball deflected into the hands of a receiver. And if you had the under, you took a really awful beat. We saw Oregon not take a knee, and not only ended up costing them a cover, it cost them a game. We saw Ohio State could have taken a knee. It would have been a non-cover, but they decided to run hurry-up while they had their backups in the game. They're running hurry-up with 3 minutes to go, up 42-6, which actually was the halftime score in that game. So, you know, I think in college you're seeing a lot of these guys, whether they're running the ball or not, they're still – the name of the game in college is to run as many plays in as short a time as you can in a set. In the NFL, I think it's more matchup-oriented. So, I mean, I think in college you're seeing these guys so averse, but I think in the NFL, they'll run their offense, but they I actually think are more prone to maybe run clock with the lead rather than, you know, hey, let's get up and hurry up and only take 10 seconds off the play clock and keep running plays. You know, in the NFL, they'll at least run the snap, run it down to 4 or 3 seconds before they do that.
Yeah, when you think about college over the last 4 to 5 years, too, and I don't know if this is maybe just because of some of the head coaching minds that you have, but, you know, we've seen, or coordinator minds even, we used to see in the past, you know, the underclassmen would come in, they'd hand the ball off 3 times, jog off the field and punt. That's not the case anymore. The underclassmen are getting their reps in game conditions, running the playbook, and that's what coaches are doing now. So definitely in some of those blowout situations, we have seen some of those bad beats, to say the least. And, Wes, the last thing I want to talk about here today on this segment on this show is coaching specifically. Lots of coaching mismatches out there. And I want to start with the NFL first. Are you prone to bet second halves based on what you believe are coaching mismatches? Or do you do a lot of your stuff, you know, based on the stats and the game flow more than looking at the coaching differences?
It's more based on the game flow, but there are certainly some spots you can find. And unfortunately, I didn't play it. I mean, I was on the Steelers for the full game, and, you know, because I just thought that the situation, because they kind of, you know, circled the wagons, even though that's kind of the Buffalo Bills thing, not really the Steelers, but they kind of together, and the team was a mess, and everybody's at each other's throats, and, you know, they were able to hang on with the win, but they were up 30-10 at the half, and I should have, and I made a mistake not playing this, because I just wanted to be safe with what I had and was comfortable with what I had. You saw that Tampa Bay came back on the Steelers, and the Steelers, you know, were kind of reverting back to the first 2 weeks, Steelers, and making mistakes, getting bad penalties, getting personal fouls, unsportsmanlike conduct. And, I mean, you even had the announcers that are rarely, that rarely call out coaches. You know, I think that they should call them out more. But they were even saying, hey, Mike Tomlin's losing control of this game. And it looked like he was. Now, they held on for a win, but obviously Tampa Bay easily covered the second half. So, you know, I think that there are certain things that you could look at for coaching. But at the same time, you look at New England-Detroit, does anybody think Matt Patricia is a better coach than Bill Belichick? Well, of course not. But Detroit, you know, he had a great game plan. And they came out, and for the second week in a row, the Patriots kind of got their ass kicked. And, you know, regardless, you know, they're like, okay, he's going to make, you know, Belichick's going to make the adjustments. Well, it never really happened. And Detroit, you know, led that thing wire to wire. So, I mean, there are certain spots you could look at, but I think you got to kind of commingle and intertwine them with the game flow and then just the pure numbers, you know, looking where the number opened and then looking where it is now, or trying to find a spot where you could find a middle, you know. But always when you're looking at a second half play, take into account not only what you're seeing on the field, but how the game was bet, you know, all week, and how the numbers moved all week, to kind of, you know, maybe give you an indicator. You want to use all of that to determine what side you land on or don't land on for a second half.
So in the NFL, we've got 32 head coaches, I think about 62 or so coordinators. I think there are a couple of head coaches that call their own plays, either offensively or defensively. When it comes to college football, we've got 130 head coaches, 250 some odd coordinators between offensive and defensive coordinators. So the gaps are going to be much larger on the college side. Do you find yourself then making more second half plays based on coaching mismatches for college?
I do, and part of that obviously is because you have substantially more games on the board than you have for the NFL. You know, it's almost like when I get to Sunday as a bettor, I'm a little relieved because it's like, hey, I got less games, you know, even though there's so much focus on the NFL and it's the most highly bet sport here in the United States, you know, it's almost a relief to only have 14 or 15 games than to have like 100-something, and then plus now with the FCS games getting added, where if any extras, where it's like, I don't even really have time to look at those. But, you know, so there's more opportunities, and there's more disparity in the coaching matchups there. And, I mean, with the NFL, the coaching disparity, I think, is mostly on experience, because you have a lot of first-year guys that have not been head coaches and, you know, have started out struggling. Part of it is because they have bad team. I mean, you think of Arizona as a primary example of that, I think. And you also have but then you have coaches that improve. I mean, you have coaches that improve and coaches that have regressed. And I think a lot of people look at John Gruden having been out of football so long. He looks like he's kind of regressed. He's not the coach he was many years ago. Or you look at Miami right now. Adam Gase is a better coach this year than he was last year. And it's not just because they have a 3-0 record, but they look like they play more consistently. They look a lot more organized. So, I mean, those are just different things you have to take into account. But, I mean, coaching matters, but I think it's a lot different in football than it is in other sports, you know, especially when you get into basketball and it's like a one-game, one-and-done tournament event. I think it's a little bit different in regular season games.
A lot of good insights here on today's program with Wes Reynolds at Wes Reynolds and the number one on Twitter. Wes, appreciate your time as always, sir. Thank you so much for joining me. We'll talk to you again soon.
You bet, Adam. Always a pleasure, man.
Lots of fun there chatting with Wes Reynolds. Great Ryder Cup breakdown. And again, like I said, I know that's maybe not everybody's preferred market out there, but the Ryder Cup is such a unique event with so many betting opportunities that I thought it was good to spend a little bit of additional time on it here on this week's worth of shows. And of course, not always a bad thing to break up all the football content. And we'll have a lot more football content for you the rest of the week. Brad Powers and Tony George, a couple of professional handicappers on tomorrow's show. Brad, of course, from bradpowersports.com. Tony from Dog Sports. Then Friday, my Westgate Super Contest selection segment. We'll see who joins me for that. But then also we'll have Brent from DSI Sportsbook for this week's version of the odds report. So lots more football coming your way here over the next 2 days on the show. One quick note I want to mention, no MLB picks and tips piece Saturday or Sunday. Look, quite frankly, this last week is a mess anyway. Certainly that last weekend going to be a big time mess. So nothing about that. But next week I'll have previews of both wildcard games and then the series previews, as well as daily picks and tips. So we'll have plenty of baseball content for you in the month of October. That'll do it for me. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.